Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, history professor Judith Stein teaches a graduate-level seminar on politics and economics in the 1970s. Professor Stein examines the 1974 resignation of President Nixon and Jimmy Carter's defeat of President Ford in the 1976 presidential election. Also discussed are President Carter's attempts to deal with inflation and the energy crisis. This class from the City University of New York Graduate Center is just under 2 hours.
Okay, because we're being joined by a C-SPAN audience today, I'm going to just review the logic of this course and where we've been so far. This course begins in 1973 and ends probably tomorrow. 1973 might seem to be an odd year to begin a course. It was not a presidential election year, nor a congressional year. But it was the year that post-war American growth faltered, wages stagnated, and productivity fell. From 1947 to 73, annual income grew about 2.7% per family. There was no growth at all from 1973 to 1980. And from 1980 to the present, annual income grew only 0.7% per family. Something was going on in the 1970s that needs explanation. Other facts deepen the rationale for this chronology. The stock market lost half of its value from 1972 to 1974. Corporate profits had already begun to decline in the late 1960s and declined further in the early 1970s. Now, it's not that we're worried about rich corporations, but it's rather that investment necessary to raise the standard of living generally comes from corporate profits. And when corporate profits decline, you get less investment. Another fact, the U.S. experienced its first trade deficit since 1893 in 1971. Trade deficits became the norm throughout the rest of the century and into the 21st century. Why is a trade deficit bad? Because it, one, increases a nation's debt, and because some of the demand is going to be supplied by foreign producers, and therefore unemployment will be higher than it normally would have been. Finally, the U.S. suffered its deepest recession since World War II in 1975 and peaked at 9.2% in May 1975. But it wasn't just the United States. Growth faltered everywhere, especially in the industrialized world, the U.S., Europe, and Japan at the time. It was the first synchronized recession since the Great Depression. Pundits called it the crisis of the West. Historians point to two main causes: the growing international competition among industrial powers, mainly Europe, the United States, and Japan, and then the quadrupling of oil prices in late 1973, which we spoke about last week, which transferred wealth to Mideast producers, yielding both recession and inflation. Both causes challenged the way Americans ran their economy after World War II. That blueprint was called the mixed economy and presumed that regulated capital, high wages, and progressive taxation would produce prosperity. The recipe was forged by the Democratic Party during the New Deal. But with strong memories of the Great Depression, the Republican Party, too, supported recipes for progress where capital and labor would progress together. A strong union movement reminded both parties of the virtues of high wages and the perils of unemployment. From 1947 to 1973, the bottom fifth of the population, that is the poorest 20%, increased its income 116%, while the top fifth only about 85%. In short, not only was there robust growth, about 3 to 4% a year, but the poor did slightly better than the rich. Given this American affluence, most politicians assumed that there was no conflict between consumption and investment, high wages and profit, and equality and growth. Then, too, Americans were so much richer than other nations that its leaders unilaterally opened the U.S. markets to the goods of its Cold War allies, rarely imagining that American industry would be damaged. This was the old blueprint. After 1980, a new recipe for progress was formulated by a new president, Ronald Reagan. Reagan argued that if the federal government reduced taxes and regulation on capital, kept inflation low and trade free, prosperity could be restored. After a very severe recession in 1981-82, growth did resume in the 1980s. Then the tech boom in the 1990s brought unemployment down to 4% in 2000. Yet in this new era, inequality rose too. In 1980, the salary of a CEO was 45 times greater than a worker in his or her plant. In 2000, it was 458 times greater. Nonetheless, the system was stable until the onset of the Great Recession in 2007 and 2008. For the remainder of the semester, we will be analyzing the story after 1980. Today, we are going to tackle the years of the 1970s when the old ways of running the economy faltered and both parties devised old and new plans to restore prosperity. Neither Reagan's election nor his program was inevitable. The book we are discussing happens to be the one that I wrote, but I know that this will not stop you from employing your usual critical faculties on our text. So let's begin. What I thought, because this book, you know, has a section on the 70s, and then there's a bookend of the previous period and a bookend of the 80s, let's start at the beginning. I think it will be easier, especially for a television audience to follow. If we begin with this section that I call the Great Compression, and I must say it's not my term, it's the term of two economists who call the period from the 47 to 73 the era of the Great Compression, meaning the compression of wage differences. Okay. What characterizes this period? Because we want to look at qualities that might help us explain what happens in the 70s. You know, but the period is distinctive, as I think I laid out at the beginning.
Well, I mean, the overall idea,
yes,
seems to be Keynesian, which is, you know, stimulating demand, consumer purchasing power through, you know, government spending, tax policies.
Okay. Can you give me some examples of Keynesian policy during this period?
Well, I think, I mean, the one example we've talked about is the Kennedy or Johnson tax cut,
mm-hmm,
in 63 or 64, which was designed to put, you know, more money back in the average American's pocket, a tax cut for the middle class.
Yeah, it was a tax cut for the middle class to stimulate aggregate demand. Part of the package was also the investment tax credit, you know, for business. Generally, tax policy in this period was a kind of combination, you know, of something for business and something for the middle class. But you're right, it was Keynesian. Did it work? Or sort of work?
For a while.
Okay, go ahead. Look, nothing is forever, right?
Right.
Okay, I mean, we don't expect it to work until yesterday. But, you know, in the years following, what was the economy like?
It was fantastic. I mean, it experienced like an unprecedented moment of growth. And you had less Americans living below the poverty line, people who had lived under the poverty line suddenly becoming owners of cars and refrigerators and toasters and all these things like that. And this huge suburban push, people moving out of urban areas and moving into suburban areas.
Okay. Any other characteristics, of this? Although the suburban push really began earlier, okay? In other words, the Keynesian tax cut it was planned in 62 or 63, passed in 64, really was when growth faltered and unemployment remained high. And that's why it was so unique. The economy was not in a recession, but just growth was insufficient, to reduce to reduce unemployment. And since employment was key, for the Democratic Party, and because people remembered the Great Depression, Kennedy was convinced that this tax cut, would reduce unemployment. And of course it did. Now, what else helped reduce unemployment? Yes.
Well, I think the fact that the U.S. was the major industrial power, you make the point, I think the statistics were that the U.S. produced 60% of all output around 1950, and that was still at 50% in 1970 and had 60% of the capital stock of advanced capitalist countries. So this was a time when the U.S. was the major economic power, not facing the competition.
But that's a comparative question. In other words, that's saying the United States is richer than Europe or Japan. But the internal question, is what happens to the richest country in the world when growth falters? And that's where the Kennedy tax cut answered the question. In other words, in order to promote growth, we're going to have to reduce taxes, mainly to stimulate aggregate demand. And that was the theory behind this, and they got that from John Maynard Keynes. So the economic policy was Keynesian, okay, and it produced prosperity. Unemployment fell to below 4% in 1969. When I was asking you what else helped, I thought one of you would mention the Vietnam War, which also stimulated the economy. This was the last American war that was fought with steel and the kind of things that stimulate the economy. I mean, today when we have laser wars, it doesn't stimulate very, very much. But Vietnam War, whatever its merits or demerits, certainly did, stimulate the economy. So between the two of them, you had a very robust economy. Now, let me ask you something. Does this robust economy, some people called it the affluent society, some people, Lyndon Johnson called it the great society, did that lead to other things? In other words, what was the effect of having an economy that was pretty successful? I mean, very successful, yes.
Well, certain people, liberals in general, specifically started to focus on post-economic issues.
Yes.
Race, the war in Vietnam, a number of other issues that sort of had little to do with sort of bread and butter economic issues.
Because they thought the economy was on autopilot. In other words, that it was working so well. And indeed, after all, one wants a good economy to improve life. And the improvements, we'll forget about the war for a moment because that will be divisive, was racial equality, the beginning of a feminist movement, beautifying America. Remember, Lady Bird Johnson, had this campaign to, if unemployment is 25%, you're not going to think of planting trees by a highway. Or, if you're thinking about trees by a highway, you might be thinking of, well, that will employ 10 people. Not that beauty is going to be the argument, and so even the nation's imperfections were explained not in terms of a defective economy, but in terms of the affluent society. In other words, the war on poverty was conceived, you know, as saying, we're so rich, why should there be poor people? You could have formulated it in a different way. Andy, what other way could you have formulated poverty in America?
Well,
I ask him because he's working on the subject, not because, you know, he's...
I guess you might say that poor people had been there all along. It's just a matter of whether rich people noticed them or not.
Okay, that's one thing. They're there all the time. Okay. But formulating why they're there all the time. Why are they there all the time? Well, how could you explain why there's poverty? You see, because the word poverty was only used in the 1960s. They didn't use poverty before the 60s. What did they call it, generally? Unemployment, right? I mean, you could argue, right, that why are people poor? Well, the economy is not producing enough jobs for people or good. But if you assume the economy is affluent, well, then you don't think to explain it in terms of an imperfect economy. It's rather, we have an obligation to the poor, which is a very different kind of an argument, is it not? You see, and what we'll see is it's not a very sturdy argument either. Okay, in that sense. You know, so too, you know, we'll see the race issue was again formulated simply on the basis of prejudice. Now, there was a huge amount of prejudice, there's no doubt about it, but a good part of black unemployment was explained not by prejudice, you know, but by the changing structure of jobs in the central cities. Yes?
Yeah, not only prejudice, but this idea of the culture of poverty that has...
Or the culture, exactly.
...characteristics of poor people themselves.
Exactly. That notion, even though the people who used that did not, as they said, blame the victim, still, you know, just to formulate it in terms of a culture of poverty implies that the economic system is okay. And throughout the 60s, you know, that... was the general notion, you know, that you know, we've learned how to manage the business cycle because we've learned Keynes, and look at what we do. We've increased economic, and this is not to diminish the achievement of the 60s, but it was a perspective, you know, so that if we look at race, poverty, what other non? I like the way you framed it, non-economic issues. Yes.
Well, maybe the environment, consumer issues, maybe more.
Yes, we saw earlier that we were beginning to see those kind of issues too, which again are non-economic issues. Or you could reframe it in another way, which is isn't it what David Vogel reframes it? He says, American capitalists or American business is so profitable that they can do anything. If they really wanted to, they could end pollution tomorrow. You know, they could beautify, they could do all of that. So that explains, you know, some of the techniques that environmentalists and other reformers used. I mean, they too imbibed this notion of affluence, but obviously they used it for their own own purposes. Okay, if the affluence of the 60s had its signature ideas, okay, and I think I think it did. What did these ideas do to the two parties? You know, the Democrat and the remember, yes.
Well, what happens is you have a shift to the center. You have Republicans that are more on the left and Democrats that are more on the right. So you have a president like Nixon who passes a very progressive tax cut, or he raises tax reform. So you just kind of have a political landscape where there's more cooperation and
You mean more cooperation than today? Everyone
just a
is
bit.
Okay.
You also you also make a point about how on the left things became more diversified as the Democratic Party became less of a party about labor and more like educated college students became identified as liberals. The Democratic Party itself became more diversified.
Okay. Now we have these two ideas. The Republican Party, at least in contrast to the Republican Party today, you know, if we argue that this notion of how you manage the economy was the dominant idea in society, well, Republicans were going to have to embrace it too if they wanted to win elections. You know, you always got, you know, some Republicans who said, well, you know, what's the difference between the Republican and the Democratic Party? We want the pure Republican Party. Well, they may have had a point, but they couldn't win elections. And if you can't win elections, you don't dominate the party. Okay, and we saw what happened in 1964 when they nominated a man, you know, who, you know, embraced very different principles, you know, from those of, you know, the more moderate Republicans. And there were many, many more of, you know, of them, too. So the Republican Party, you know, must embrace this. And I don't mean that someone pointed a gun at them and required them to do it. I mean, they did it with their volition. Many Republicans supported labor unions and were liberal, they used to be called. I mean, today we might call them moderate, but they were liberal Republicans, and many of them came from New York State. Yes?
Yeah, and like liberals, they had their own different batch of post-economic issues that they focused on, like law and order and family.
That's right.
And
I mean, exactly. Those, I mean, and this gets us to Nixon. I mean, those also are post-economic issues, law and order, family. I mean, they are more conservative than the post-economic issues of the left. But they also, I mean, Nixon also assumed, you know, that this economy was fine. And who was the one who mentioned his tax cuts, his business tax cuts? I can't remember. Well, we all know it. But, I mean, he reduced the capital gains tax. He got rid of the investment tax credit, which business loved. And why did he do it? His economic advisor said, we have so much growth. What do we need this for? Now, this doesn't sound like a Republican or a Democrat today, you know, but it was part of this era when it looked as if growth was self-sustaining. And so the Republicans had their post-economic issues. But let's get back to Brooks' divisions within the Democratic Party. Now, the reason why I think it's so important to talk about the Democratic Party is because it was the majority party in the country. It, you know, today the majority of Americans register as independents. You know, there's still slightly more Democrats than Republicans. But at this point, there were very few independents. And the Democrats overwhelmed Republicans 2-1. I mean, so it was the normal majority party unless something happened, like as we'll see in 1968, you know, when divisions, you know, in the party become great. But I like Brooks' idea of the new issues creating divisions within the party. You know, and so how does that manifest itself? What issue crystallizes it?
I think speaking broadly, you could put you could form two categories. So on the one hand, you have a group of liberals who are concerned with cultural issues and minority rights, and on the other hand, you have a group that's interested in jobs and employment. In other words, a labor movement.
Okay. Go ahead, Ben. Yeah.
The continuing fissures over Vietnam.
Yeah, isn't that the big one? I mean, you're absolutely right that there are all of these, but the big one that explodes, I mean, that's the issue that explodes in 1968, you know, and indeed allows Nixon to win, you know, so let's talk a little bit about this, about the war. I mean, not so much the war in itself, but the war's relationship you know, to fissures within the Democratic Party. I mean, how does it manifest itself?
Well, I think, you know, the party's new direction, it seems, in the early 70s is towards more towards affluent, college-educated suburbanites who are also, in many ways, the core of the anti-war movement.
Yes.
At the same time. So those two things are kind of happening, which means that the party is starting to move a little bit away from its working class base towards a more affluent kind of segment of the population.
I think that puts it pretty well. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's evident in the changes in party rules that they were able to
affect. Let's talk about that, because this is something that people, you know, often forget about. I mean, we are in the primary season right now, and everyone thinks that you know, this is the way Americans have always chosen their presidents. But really, this primary system, you know, has its origins in just the phenomenon we're talking about. Brooke, you want to talk a little bit about it? I know it's esoteric and it's something that lawyers understand better than laymen. But why did this primary system as a method of selecting presidential candidates, you know, begin? I mean, how were candidates, you know, chosen before?
By the party.
By their parties, by party conventions, by party the reformers bosses. Would say, yes, yeah, the reformers would call them party bosses. You know, to use a more neutral word, we would say party leaders. Okay, and I think it's better to call them, you know, to use as neutral a word as is possible. Okay, so what's the link between these reformers and the Vietnam issue that we just mentioned? I mean, many of the party reformers had been activists. You know, in the 68 convention, you know, and had either supported Eugene McCarthy, actually most of them, the first challenger to Lyndon Johnson, you know, and then some of them also, you know, supported Robert Kennedy when he got into the race, and from the perspective of these people, you know, they said, look, why did the Democratic Party get into the Vietnam War? Well, it's because we anti-war groups are marginalized from party decisions. The party bosses make the decision. Maybe if people like us, and we'll talk about who is people like us, made the decisions, we wouldn't have war. I mean, we wouldn't have gotten into Vietnam. Okay, I mean, that really was the animus which led, they believed that they were robbed in 1968, that actually the candidate, whether you liked him or not, Hubert Humphrey, was the majority candidate of Democrats polled. You know, but they imagined, you know, as activists often do, you know, that they were cheated. They were cheated out of a nomination that Eugene McCarthy or before his assassination, Robert Kennedy couldn't do it. So that they go, you know, they go to this project, you know, which was headed by McGovern, the senator from with the notion that we're going to overturn the bosses, and the way we're going to do it is the primary system. In other words, we're not going to have bosses choose candidates. We're going to have either the primary or the party caucus, you know, where people come and yes.
Do you think the loss in 68 created an opening for these reformers?
Sure.
Was that?
Sure. In other words, if Humphrey had won, I doubt whether
anybody would have listened to them.
Exactly. I mean, look, we don't know. That's what we call a counterfactual, and we can't tell. But certainly that Humphrey lost. Gave them, and then of course, you know, many of the party people didn't quite understand what was happening, you know, because you know you could make an argument: how could these rank amateurs, you know, overwhelm these sophisticated, you know, party bosses? But in fact, they did. Now, all of the effects of the primary system did not happen immediately. But what are some of the characteristics of a primary process of selecting candidates, you know, with respect to the makeup of the party? Rook, yeah.
Well, generally, the candidates go at each other during the entire primary system and kind of rip each other. All of their weaknesses are kind of on display for everyone to see before they even get to the national election. Mm-hmm. So in general, it kind of creates more center, center-based, bland candidates.
Not at first. I mean, at first they're playing to the party's base, so then they feel like usually veer straight into the center afterward.
They try to.
Yeah.
They try to. I mean, actually, if you're fighting for a primary, you tend to go after your constituency and forget about the rest until afterwards.
I mean, it's much more about like doctrinal purity, right, at that level.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why George Wallace did so well in Florida, you know, because he argued, what is my base? White Southern conservatives. I mean, white Southern racists or whatever you want to call them. That's what he got. But it also, doesn't it stress personality as opposed to party? In other words, you know, even when you get after the Watergate public funding of elections, I mean, the money goes to candidates, not parties. You know, so it makes it difficult for parties as an entity, to make decisions. You know, so there is a link between the dissension over Vietnam in 1968, you know, with its demographic split within the party, you know, between, I mean, this is crude, the working class and the professional classes. The professional classes reform the party. They want the party, you know, to be dominated by people like them. I mean, obviously they're going to use the language of democracy. Everyone does. But that doesn't make it democratic, because we know that if you look at primary voters, in general, they're more affluent than regular voters. I mean, this was true in 1972, and it's true in 2012. You know, so that there's, it's more complicated than simply let the people decide. I mean, those kinds of slogans rarely mean exactly what they said. So what does this primary system, and of course afterwards the Republicans follow them. Initially. So what does this do in 1972? Yes.
Well, I think what's significant about McGovern losing, in not the primary, but the election, is because he didn't have kind of the labor base.
Okay.
So we talk about this kind of divergence of these professionals, like idealist kind of reformers of the party, you know. So McGovern had those, but he didn't have the labor, kind of like the working class.
Right.
So kind of, you know, this divergence in the party.
And it's hard to win an election in 1972 without the support of labor. He didn't do very well. He won the District of Columbia and Massachusetts.
I was going to say, did he have a base? I felt like that was the point.
Yeah, that's a good, Lydia, that's a very good question. Well, you know, exactly his base. I mean, one, you know, the remnants from the anti-war.
You have Jesse Jackson who's saying, I'm not going to support Nixon, but I'm not going to campaign for McGovern.
Jackson trying to, you know, milk the system. You're right. Jesse Jackson said, you know, at first he was a McGovern delegate, you know, and then he was trying to play hard to get in 1970. That was part of McGovern's problem. He tried, you know, to harness some of the new social movements. But it was hard to do it because often the new social movements were more interested in their own cause than the cause of the party. You know, and then while Jesse Jackson supported McGovern, or at least in Act One, you know, of the drama, you know, what about, I quote the black head of the AFL-CIO in Detroit Now, this is the heart of the Democratic Party. I mean, generally every campaign began in Detroit because of the strength of the labor movement. And so here's this black head of the AFL-CIO in Wayne County, Detroit, and he goes to the McGovern campaign, and he introduces himself, and he said, you know, I didn't expect them to know who I was, but I was very surprised that when they found out, they didn't give a damn. In other words, I mean, you know, the people who were within the campaign, you know, thought labor was reactionary. And now, Lydia's point, well, who was his constituency? Well, McGovern did well, although not that well, in the college towns. You know, if you look at the college towns, but then again, you know, college students often don't turn out very, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, this is not simply a phenomenon of 1972. I won't draw any conclusions about other elections, you know. But I think what he was trying to do, you know, at one point Wallace said, well, you know, maybe I can get. Sorry, McGovern said, maybe I can get the Wallace voters. Wallace voters? He had this idea that maybe he could capture the alienated. And he conceptualized the Wallace voters as alienated, as well as the students. And, well, of course, it didn't work. So he lost massively, but why do I call it the last election of the 60s? Although this is a book about the 70s, you know, I'm not so rigorous about chronology. You know, I call it the last issue of the 70s. I mean, 60s, sorry.
I mean, this
even though it was 1972. Yes. Yes. Barrett. Okay, Ryan.
Well, these were still kind of post-economic issues.
That's right. Remember, okay, and also, you know, if you try to make this an ideological election, you know, it's hard to explain certain facts in this, and that is, you know, McGovern lost massively, but Democrats gained in the Senate, and they just lost a few in the House. And they had massive, you know, majorities. Generally, in ideological elections, you know, you have not just a president losing, you know, but you have a sweep of the opposing party. But you don't see that in 1972. That's why, you know, the explanation must be, you know, that many people, you know, did not think McGovern, you know, without going into the details of his campaign, which would not run very, very well, you know, but my point is that it's hard to make it an ideological election because one, or, you know, in terms of economic issues, which is the issue that we're talking about. And, you know, even Nixon, he runs in 1972, not as Barry Goldwater in 64. You know, he didn't run to repeal civil rights laws. You know, he obviously, you know, wasn't going to enforce them as vigorously as a Democratic president was. You know, but, you know, as you go down the line, you know, these issues, are similar. So it is the last election of the 60s simply because the economy. Now, let's start on the economy because there was one economic issue which Nixon dealt with before this 1973, which we're sort of beginning with, when they discovered that there was a trade deficit. And although in 1971 this did not rock the nation, I mean, if you were walking on the street, I doubt whether anyone would say, oh my God, we have a trade deficit. But it rocked the government itself. Okay? It rocked the government itself. The mighty United States, you know, is suffering a trade deficit when we've had trade surpluses since 1893. So that's important. And then when the United States, partly to solve this problem, goes off gold, which essentially devalues the dollar. I mean, the reason for that is many of the people in power thought that the expensive dollar, okay, made exports more expensive and encouraged imports. So that if you go off gold, which they did, and force our allies to accept a cheaper dollar, everything would be fine. And remember, when he did that, because going off gold and cheapening the dollar would have been inflationary, this was the origin of his wage and price controls. He established a border tax, you know, to get America's allies to accept a cheaper dollar. What a border tax is you put a 10% increase, you know, a tariff on imports. And it's known to be temporary because of a balance of payments problem. And of course, the United States had this. So there was this package which initially seemed to work. Now, I suggest that one of the reasons why it worked was because there was a boom in 1972 and 3. And when there's a boom, Germany decides that it doesn't need to ship machinery to the United States. Japan decides it doesn't need to ship cars to the United States. They use it in their own domestic economy. And so as much as the cheaper dollar might have helped, you know, limit the trade deficit, the worldwide boom of 72 and 73 probably also was a reason for this too, okay? So that it appeared that Nixon had solved the economic question too. I mean, it rears its ugly head in 71, but it appears as if this plan that he put out, you know, was solving the problem. You know, because in 1972 and 1973, the beginning of the economy seems to rebound and grow. In that sense. So we're at the end of our period, however, because 1973, although it starts off pretty well, you know, and one of the reasons why I quote head of the Chamber of Commerce saying nice things about Ralph Nader, you know, the consumer advocate who generally business, you know, abhors, you know, is because business in early 73, you know, profits were resuming, they felt comfortable, and so they were able to say, well, Nader is simply making capitalism more efficient and better and all of this. Now, you can cite other people, but this ends later in the year when oil prices quadrupled. Okay, now that is another shock to both the national and the international system. Let's talk about it. What does it do? We spoke a little bit about it last week, when we were talking about the international situation where the United States no longer had a surplus oil which could balance oil prices globally. Texas used to be, you know, the surplus area, and now, you know, the balance of power was in the Middle East. And so that, of course, raises a strategic issue. What about domestically? A strategic issue of a new source of power.
At the same time, domestically, the demand for oil was rising in the United States, which amplified the problem.
That's right. I mean, and in part because, you know, in the post-war world, and this is true of Japan and Europe as well as the United States, you know, people switched from coal, you know, which was polluting, you know, to oil, you know, using everything. I mean, whether it's heating a home, whether it's heating factories, obviously the growth of the automobile, you know, which was a Western, not simply an American, an American phenomenon. And of course, all of this was possible, you know, because oil was plentiful and cheap. Okay, you know, so when in fact, and of course all of the new the new chemical industry, petrochemicals, they were all the synthetic products, and we're all oil based, you know, so you know, plastics, nylon, you know, you name it. I mean, all of this was oil based, so that when oil quadruples in price, forgetting about internationally, I mean, it affects the domestic economy. 2% of GDP was transferred from the United States to the Middle East. Okay, that sucks out demand that could have gone to buying automobiles or buying, you know, buying almost anything. At the same time, it obviously raises prices and causes inflation. You know, so you have both. And it's not surprising why you have both. You know, it's because this is not a normal kind of recession or inflation. I mean, this is a rise of a commodity price. You know, which so what does the country do then? You know, when this vital raw material, has quadrupled in price. Yes.
Well, the fact that it's no longer so easy to make profits kind of reignites the conflict between capital and labor that people thought had gone away.
Yeah. In other words, it disturbs, you know, the whatever you want to call it, the agreement between labor and capital. Because, you know, the question is, who's going to pay for this expensive oil? Is it going to come out of profits or is it going to come out of wages? Now, no one ever articulated it in such crude terms. But basically, that is exactly what happened. And this is played out in almost every issue, you know, whether it's ordinary wages, you know, whether it's what do we do, you know, with the price of oil, you know, do we continue to subsidize the price of oil, you know, people representing consumers said, of course. You know, you have to, because if you let prices rise, poor people's wages will decline. On the other hand, Republicans, you know, and businessmen said, absolutely not. You know, you have to let the price of oil, you know, move up, you know, because that's the new price. And to subsidize it, you know, will not be efficient and will be only a short run, solution. What did other countries do? Because that also impinges upon what the United States does. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the primary concern was getting oil.
Right. Okay. Was getting oil. And how are they going to pay for this costly oil? Yes.
Well, Japan and Germany increased exports.
That's right.
To stimulate their economy.
Okay, exactly. In other words, they said, if we're going to have to pay more for oil, we're going to have to export more. Now, did the United States do that? No. Why didn't the United States do that?
Yes. The thing you keep bringing up throughout the book is this continuing subordination of economic interests, domestic economic interests, sort of international Cold War politics.
That's right. In other words, because the United States used this big, rich market to cement alliances. If you think about the countries that did quite well, they were all countries that were important in the Cold War. Germany, Japan, and later on Korea, Taiwan. In this sense. And even as industry was struggling, this strategic component, the way I try to prove this, you know, is, and here is where historians have advantages over other, I mean, in the sense that we look at primary sources, you know, and so I'm not making this out of cold cloth. I mean, I quote, for instance, people like Kissinger, you know, who would tell Nixon, okay, you may have a problem with, shall we say, shoes, subsidized shoes in Spain, but if we impose dumping violations, we're not going to get bases in Spain, which we need for NATO. Or if we come down too hard on shoes in Italy, the communists are going to get power in Italy. And, of course, strategically, we don't want that. So, in other words, the strategic trumps foreign economic policy. And this is a theme that goes on from the beginning of the Cold War, when America is initially rich, and then when America and indeed, it's bipartisan. Exactly. There's no difference between the two, the two parties on that. And I suspect if you look today, and of course we don't have access to the papers of President Obama's Secretary of the Treasury and all of this, you would find the same argument going on about China. But of course, since I don't have access to those papers today, I can't make that statement. But on the basis of the president's papers that I have examined, I'm assuming that is still the case. In other words, in the case of China, that the Americans are more concerned with North Korea, you know, than about the Chinese currency. But that's another story. That's another story for the future. You know, so that what we see is that this oil struggle both taxes the domestic economy, but also reignites the competition, you know, for industrial goods among Germany, Japan, or Japan, the United States, and Europe, but it's mainly Germany in. And does this get articulated in the elections? Because in 1976, as the United States struggled through the deep recession of 1975, that was the year when the city of New York nearly went bankrupt, okay, in part because of these problems. President Ford, who succeeded Nixon after Nixon was forced to resign in 1974 because of Watergate, I mean, Ford himself, you know, wanted to stress inflation because he thought, like many businessmen in 1974, that the reason why there's inflation is because there's too much demand from workers, and there are not enough profits. And the way to enhance profits is to reduce two things: working class wages and social expenditures. That's government expenditures for welfare and health and all of this. And the problem was that although, yes, there was inflation, the increase in oil prices also produced a deep recession. And Ford was forced to deal with that, even though he was reluctant. To do this. And remember, he dealt with it after the 1974 elections. And the 1974 elections, remember, produced huge Democratic majorities. In the North, it was mostly because of Watergate, and you get get Republicans, moderate Republicans, you know, who were revolted by Watergate, moving into the Democratic Party, again making the party, you know, more responsive to more affluent people, and no passing notes in class. But in the South, and this is something that I think is important to see, it was the economic issue that brought Democratic gains. You know, people often argue, you know, that it was inevitable, and they quote Lyndon Johnson, that the South was going to remain Republican, you know, because of 1965. Well, I mean, that is Johnson's opinion, you know, in 1965. If you look at the results of the election in 1974, moderate Democrats did quite well. And if you add the new black representatives, you know, from Congress, you know, from the South. In the mid-70s, the Southern congressional delegation was a lot more liberal than it had been, you know, in probably 30 years. And so what I'm suggesting is that, you know, race is not the ever-present explanation of everything, and that Democratic policies may also have something to do with it, because in 1974, you know, you see many of the white Republicans returning to the Democratic Party, you know, after the deep recessions and the closing of furniture factories, textile mills, etc., which was the result of the repression. So what you get, what you get is the Republicans are on the defensive after 74. Watergate is one, and the bad economy, you know, is the other, which sets us up for 1976.
He goes from, like, Ford, I think.
Yes.
The really interesting part for me is that he goes from a tax surcharge to a tax cut. Like, he does an about face right after.
He does an about face. And
so
that's...
The Republicans are very much pushed into a corner.
Yes, exactly. You're exactly right. You know, his instinct, and remember, the head of the Council of Economic Advisers is Alan Greenspan. Right, and he believes, you know, that inflation is caused by higher wages and spending. You know, that's an ideological conclusion. You see, and he thought that what was going to happen was business investment, you know, would take up the slack and we'd get prosperity. But because there was a deep recession. You know, there was a decline in investment as well as demand, and consumption. You know, and again, elections are important in democracies. After they lose the elections, they realize, you know, that they've got to address, you know, the unemployment issue. Remember, in the 70s, the unemployment issue was still a live issue where people remembered the Great Depression. And so it was probably more important then than it is today, when that kind of memory, you know, probably is non-existent, you know, for any politician. But it's still so that Ford himself then, even though, you know, his heart was not in it. I mean, Lydia, you get the point very nicely. You know, he's forced to reverse, but he doesn't like it. But it has an effect. You know, economic growth grows. Unemployment is still, you know, over 7%. That's the fly in the ointment, which sets up the possibility, you know, for 1976 for the Democrats. And the Democrats nominate a man who probably if the old, I'm not going to say party bosses, but if the party leaders had chosen a man, I doubt whether they would have chosen Jimmy Carter. Why? I mean, he barely got through.
I was going to say, I feel like the converse is actually a question.
What?
Like, why did he get chosen? And that, I think, you show really well in your book, in terms of the fact that it's the sort of fragmented Democratic Party and... also the campaign reform, but you have where Hubert Humphrey thinks that he's going to get called in from the reserves for the Democratic nomination,
right.
And he says, why would I, like, we haven't sunk that far to sort of accept somebody who doesn't really want
right.
to be president.
Right. You know, there were many, many candidates, because with the new campaign reform, you know, it became cheaper to run, and so many people ran. You know, and many of them were liberals, you know, and they sort of killed off each other, you know, in that sense. And Carter really won. I mean, he wins. This was the first time that Iowa becomes, you know,
important.
Exactly. and essentially what Carter does is he camps out in Iowa, you know, and he still... doesn't win a majority of the Iowa caucuses, the undeclared slate wins, the majority or the plurality, I think 33%. But Carter won does better than any other real candidate. And the fact that he was so unknown, you see, you know, he had what then becomes momentum. You know, and so the dynamic that's familiar with us today in the way primaries are run really, really starts here. Yes.
Yeah, another reason for Carter's rise is the point you made earlier about the difference in primaries. And that is that substance is privileged over style is privileged over substance, and he was this great character.
Yes,
that had a lot of appeal.
Yes, one of the reasons why Lydia mentions that I call this chapter on 1976 morality versus economy is that Carter believed that because of Watergate, you know, the issue of morality would be a big issue. You know, and this is also a non-economic issue, right? I mean, he thought that McGovern had the right idea, but because Watergate broke too late, you know, although Watergate occurred in 1972, you know, it became popular or it became known only after the election. And so he thought that one, he could do a better job because Watergate was now known, and he also, as Jimmy Carter often thought, he was a superior vessel. In other words, he was a better candidate than McGovern. But you know, there was a great deal of opposition to him, in part because he was only, you know, a one-term governor. And although he was a very smart man, there's no doubt about that, you know, his national experience was limited. He had one other virtue for the politics of the mid-70s. I mean, he was a Southerner, right? And remember, he was one of the Southern moderates that was elected in 1970. You know, there were others. You know, and so, you know, he became symbolic of a new generation that perhaps could put the ugly race issue of the South behind him. This especially was true when he beat George Wallace in Florida. And at that point, he was embraced. You know, I mean, George Wallace was the hobgoblin, you know, of liberal minds. You know, in other words, they feared him, they feared his poison, even though by 1976, because, you know, a man tried to assassinate him, you know, in 72, and because, you know, after blacks began voting in numbers, you know, he began his mea culpa to the black community saying, "I'm sorry, I never meant what I did. And even that, you know, his constituency was really, white, you know, racist, in the South, and many Northern liberals, you know, feared, you know, that potency, you know, which could be effective even in the North when Wallace switches, you know, from the overt race issue to the kind of elites don't understand, you know, the working class. I mean, that kind of populist message, you know, which he began to use. And so that when Jimmy Carter slays him, I mean, not literally, beats him in the Florida, I mean, Jimmy Carter would never, never do that. Never. The primaries never got as divisive as that. You know, but when he beat them, I mean, many liberals who knew absolutely nothing about Jimmy Carter, you know, said, "He's our man." Yes.
Well, right, and this is how Carter was able to kind of squeak through while admittedly not knowing much about the economy. And when he did say things about the economy, it wouldn't have been what those voters actually wanted to hear.
Right, right. But let's look at it in another way, because the Democrats win. Now, what's interesting about the victory in 76, it was narrow. I think it was a little over 50% of the vote that Carter got. You know, but the majorities in the Senate and House remain. And so Carter then is the president under conditions which are approaching Lyndon Johnson's in 1964. In other words, he has good majorities in both houses. Now, that encouraged many Democrats to think, aha, the economy is getting better. We can do a whole reform agenda, right? I mean, so they want to do, what are they, national health insurance, consumer energy, labor reform, maybe a little tax reform, certainly a tax stimulus, Humphrey Hawkins, in other words, full employment. In other words, the Democrats misread the economy too, in part because they were never forced to do it, especially with the new leadership, which is more suburban, it's more affluent, than the working class. But nonetheless, there is this notion that the economy is fine again, and so we can complete the reform agenda of the 1960s. Now, there are several problems with that. Let's talk about that. What's wrong with that as a, as a blueprint? Well, I mean, what is it ignoring?
Well, the economy is not fine anymore.
Yeah, right. There are still, I mean, there, unemployment is still, is still high. The oil issue. Until the Iranian Revolution has calmed down, in part because the recession in 1975 had the effect of reducing oil prices. So that the oil issue, can be put aside. But what about American international policy?
Yeah, you make a point in the book about how the U.S. doesn't continues taking more exports in order to help the global economy, kind of focusing on the global economy and not realizing the kind of the domestic fallout from that decision.
From that, exactly. And here maybe, we said both parties, are similar to that. But in some sense, maybe the Democratic Party, at least at this moment, is more invested in this, for the reason that the Republicans still have, some business interests, and they also have, are more militaristic. The Democrats, believe that they can, especially after Vietnam, and with the growth of, a more Pacific small Pacific, Democrats in the party, that they can manage the world through economic policy. And so they come into office, and I mentioned this trilateral commission, which I don't know whether people today, hear about, but it was begun by David Rockefeller in the early 70s, and it was supposed to be a way of integrating Japan, into the, quote, Western world, after the growth of Japan's economy. But it was a combination of businessmen, some labor leaders, some intellectuals at colleges like Brzezinski was part of it. And they tended to be internationalists, free traders. Okay, they had different foreign policy positions, but they generally spoke about the New World Order, not balance of power. In other words, they thought that they could harmonize the world. Now, the left viewed this, as a capitalist conspiracy. The right viewed this as an internationalist conspiracy. But basically, this was kind of, liberal capitalist elites, throughout the world. And so They devised method, and what's important is this organization didn't have institutional power, but many of its members populated the Carter administration. Carter was a member, you know, of it. Mondale was a member of it. Brzezinski was one of the founders. You go, and so they're all into this world. Therefore, it's not surprising, you know, that when they look at the world and they see that, yes, we're not in the terrible recession that we all were in 1975, which led us to meet together as the G7. It wasn't called the G7, but this was the first international gathering of, you know, of the big powers. You see, before the recession of 1975, whenever there was a world problem, the Americans solved it alone. But by 75, what we see is this interconnection. You know, so we have this first summit, as they called it. Now, why did they call it a summit? This was in the midst of the 1975 recession. Well, first of all, the word summit, you know, implies the summits between the Soviets and the U.S. I mean, it's a place of great, you know, gravity. You know, but it obviously continued, and today we have G20, right? I mean, it's expanded. You know, but basically, you know, the Trilateral Commission and the Carter administration, you know, sort of thought that we can only get out of it by coordinating. The problem was that the American role was to be, remember the locomotive? What's the locomotive in the world recovery? Yes.
Well, the U.S. allows other countries to export their products during a recession into American markets.
How do they do it? One, yes, they don't put up tariffs, but what they do is through a stimulus, right? You know, in other words, through a stimulus, you rev up the economy, and certainly, you know, generally, when an economy is doing well, it gets more imports, and the United States argued that this was important for the non-oil developing countries. In other words, that's, you know, as well as, you know, the big, you know, industrialized power. And the United States wanted to get Japan and Germany to do the same thing. In other words, there would be three locomotives to this train, you know, and then the world would be made better. But what was the problem? Why, Japan and Germany didn't see it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already said that they exited the recession by increasing their exports. And they were not convinced that stimulating their own economy and certainly accepting more imports was going to do them very good. So this was part of the problem. And so when the United States stimulates its economy, as Jimmy Carter does, in his first year, they get a lot of imports, and they're then asking Germany and Japan to do the same. But they are most reluctant. You know, as we saw last time, Germany was, you know, promised to do something, and they did it only with a deal with the United States that the United States would decontrol the price of oil, which would help Germany by reducing the world price of oil. Yes?
So it seems like one of the problems with this internationalist perspective is the idea of free trade, because free trade is not going on everywhere. You put like a French politician in here who says free trade is an Anglo-Saxon myth.
Yes.
Because what Germany and Japan are doing is anything but free trade. I mean,
yes, that is part of the problem. The United States ideologically, you know, had been free trade since Cordell Hull. In the 30s, and most other countries were less enamored with free trade. I mean, they basically saw these trade agreements as agreements among mercantilist states. But the United States, you know, didn't see it that way. And if you quote the American leaders, you know, they'll often say, well, we have to do more, even when parochial interests are hurt. Well, parochial interests, you know, are American domestic. And, you know, what's interesting about this Trilateral Commission is that there's no representative of simply national capital. You know, most of them are internationalists, capital and bankers. Which are on the, and so it's not surprising. It's not surprising that the United States gets, however you measure imports and exports, it gets more imports from Japan and Germany, and it also gets more imports from the developing world, which at that point, were Korea, Taiwan. I mean, not countries that today we would be considered developing, world, but Korea, Taiwan, other East Asian countries, Brazil and Mexico. In other words, the bigger developing countries, and the United States always took in more than Europe and Japan did. So that then causes problems because, with the stimulus, but with some of the American demand being fulfilled with exports, that encourages inflation. And so the United States gets the worst of both worlds. In other words, it gets more inflation, and it also gets higher unemployment. Okay, yes.
You mentioned early on that the U.S. has switched from producing goods to a more service based economy, and that by 1965, the U.S. companies are investing 50% more in foreign countries than in the U.S.
Right.
Did this affect this kind of internationalist bent in policy at all?
Yes. Well, let me put it this way. I think I see what you're saying. In other words, that this policy creates interests.
Right.
To some extent, that's true. But what was striking to me, reading the policy people in the Carter administration, was they didn't argue it that way. In other words, they didn't say, as people today say, we are now in a service economy, manufacturing is unimportant. Rather, they denied that there was a manufacturing problem. In other words, all of these administrations believed that manufacturing was important. Okay, but they denied that there was a problem. And so it was more, it was less the interests of multinationals, which over time, as they get stronger and bigger, will exert weight on American foreign policy. Okay, but at this point, I found, yes, some. I mean, the heart of the free traders, among businessmen, were the international companies, that produced abroad, like the big companies, like GM, like GE. I mean, and all of this, and yes, but you had a substantial group of domestic companies, and of course, you have the labor unions. I mean, they are the ones, who first bear the brunt of this, and the FL-CIO switches from free trade to something called fair trade, managed trade, or something in 1969, early, and of course one of the solutions to this problem, that labor proposes, is to limit, imports. And to tax multinationals. In other words, they're arguing, that free trade is leading to investment abroad, and the loss of jobs. They're saying, well, why are there few manufacturing jobs? And they're arguing, that it's because multinationals put plants abroad. Why do they put plants abroad? For many reasons. One is obviously cheap labor. But initially, it was not so much cheap labor, but they couldn't get into foreign markets. You see, if the tariff wall is up here and you can't sell products from the United States, you know, you put a plant in a country, you know, and then once then you're like a domestic, you're like a domestic country, and so then you don't, no longer, you know, petition the American government, you know, for market access, because you don't need it, because you're already producing, you know, in a foreign country. And that's really, you know, how it started in Europe, you know, as the European Economic, Commission, you know, sets up pretty high tariff walls in order to create unity, you know, in Europe. Now, of course, the French complained all the time and said, it's the American invasion, they're putting plants in, and that's, of course, one way to look at it. You know, but the other way is that, you know, American factories or American corporations are, you know, substituting plants for exports from the United States. And in Europe, it was not essentially because of cheaper labor. You know, you begin to get the cheap labor argument or you know, in the midst of this 1975 recession, you know, and you know, where you get corporations putting plants into these developing countries, I mean the big developing countries, you know, in this sense. And at that point, because profits are being squeezed, you know, the cheap labor argument then, but you know, becomes one that's useful to the corporations, you know, in that sense. And at the same time, what we see is as OPEC dollars are channeled in American banks, they will begin to lend more to these developing countries to build their steel mills, to build their car mills, and this sets up the conflict between American finance and American production, because, yeah, the only way, if I'm a banker, first Citibank, wasn't Citibank, it was, what is it, in any event, National Citibank, if I'm lending money to country X to build a steel mill, okay, and I want to get my loan back, if this country can't export to the United States, I'll never get my loan back. You know, so this sets up, you know, a conflict of interest between American banks, you know, and American industry, which you first really see in the late 70s. You know, this exists today, in every way. So these are some of the problems that the Democrats don't see, and meanwhile, the Republicans, or at least the business community, remember a couple of weeks ago we spoke about the mobilization of the business community, and they mobilized in the early 70s, in part, you know, because of this crisis, and their profits are reduced, and also they believe that the government is regulating too much, and therefore too much of their investment is going to items like anti-pollution instead of investment. And so they begin mobilizing, and they oppose many of the items on this reform agenda. But probably the most important thing they oppose, that is labor's attempt to speed up the process of unionization. Because by the late 70s, isn't it so that the labor movement realizes that their numbers are shrinking? The peak of labor union membership in the country was in the mid-50s. And they realized that where are many plants going in the United States? They're going south and west. And these are the areas where you have the fewest unions. So they thought that if we can reform the process to make it easier for workers, you know, to join unions, I mean, that would be good. That would be good for the union movement, and obviously they think it's good for the country, too. And so they advocate this labor reform, you know, and in essence, big business, even those that negotiate with labor, you know, oppose it. And they lose this issue. I mean, they're able to get majorities, but they lose it in the Senate when basically Jimmy Carter refused to make it a priority because he wasn't. Now, you know, as a president, he was not like a Democrat usually was. The Democrats usually got along with labor. I mean, no president ever had exactly the same agenda as the labor movement did, but they recognized labor as an important player in the Democratic Party. It was the biggest mass organization in the party. Carter was not, right? I mean, he's a different kind of a Democrat. I mean, he was more like one of these new Democrats. In other words, you know, he was uncomfortable. He didn't deal with labor unions. In Georgia, there were never, you know, certainly the head of the AFL-CIO is George Meany with his cigar. You know, was not the kind of person that Carter liked. So, you know, he was uncomfortable, you know, with the personnel and also with the people. Yes, Lydia?
I mean, do you really think he didn't like him? I have the sense that the Democrats misread the economy, but they also misread Jimmy Carter. And he was running as an outsider from Washington after, you know, Watergate and whatnot, so anti-corruption. But he had to govern and, you know, negotiate in Washington, and he wasn't able to do that, is my understanding, accurately, right? So not only was he running on being from outside Washington, but then that is how he, in fact, governed throughout his administration.
You're right. There was a misreading. And, of course, this, you know, why was there a misreading? I mean, I hate to put it in for the party bosses, but the party bosses would have recognized this problem. But if you go primary by primary, you know, and you get, you know, a kind of personal appeal, you know, you get a person like that. And, you know, indeed, I mean, certainly the anti-Washington theme was one theme in American politics, but the question is, was it the most productive theme for the Democratic Party, which, after all, is a party that claimed to represent, you know, workers. You know, it never was a labor party, but you know, the working class was an important constituency, and a man like Carter, you know, was someone who was unfamiliar with labor issues, and it was antithetical to his way of governing. I mean, it was hard for him to govern anyway. I mean, you know, in part because his personal style. I mean, one of his aides called it a Jesus in the wilderness style, meaning, you know, he listened to other people, but he kept his own counsel. And, you know, often that is not the best way. So the point is that there are problems, but and you know, the labor movement loses labor reform, and as we'll see in a moment, Carter loses tax reform. And probably that is the most important issue, in the sense he comes in with the notion that we're going to make taxes fairer. Now, everybody wants fair taxes. You know, I mean, so what does that mean? Well, he puts together, you know, a sort of combination of things, which gets rid of the capital gains tax and does several other things. But the problem is, you know, it doesn't intersect with the economy. It doesn't intersect with the notion that productivity is falling. You know, and that you need to do something for the economy. You know, and so, you know, to make a long story short, business, and not just business, but the financial community comes up with a solution which is very popular, and that is to reduce the capital gains tax. Now, that is a tax which even the corporate, now let me explain about the cap. It means that, you know, it means that when you buy and sell securities, you're taxed lower than the ordinary rate on wage income, you know, in this sense. Now, what was the rationale for this? You know, they argued if you reduce the tax, you will free up capital for investment. How? Well, I sell, let's say, 100 shares of stock, and I get $100, let's say, in this sense. Well, what do I do? Well, I probably then take it to my Wall Street broker and say, do something with the $100. Ah, who's going to like the capital gains tax? Wall Street. The corporations didn't like that. The for this reason. As I said earlier, they generally got their investment from corporate profits. So they preferred a reduction in the corporate income tax, or they preferred give me money if I put the investment tax credit. The theory behind that was you build me a factory and we'll give you a tax credit. But what this did was it simply gave a lower tax rate to people who in general were wealthy on the promise that they might do something. You see, and so, you know, most economists argue, you know, that lowering this tax, remember, Nixon raised it. So this is not simply a Republican issue. Nixon raised it, of course, in 1969 in a different era. Okay, but in 1978, Wall Street and the financial community was able to convince liberal Republicans and liberal Democrats that this would be a way to improve the economy. In other words, this was not simply a tax that was levied because Wall Street was so strong. It wasn't. But it had a rationale, and Carter had no rationale for his tax policy. You know, so that what happens in 1978 is this is the first time that you get a regressive tax bill, you know, since, you know, World War II, or since the, you know, or since, actually, it may have been since the beginning of the income tax, you know, in this sense. Because generally, remember, as I said, there were balanced tax cuts. Without going into every bit of detail of this tax cut, I mean, generally, you know, it was the wealthiest of Americans, you know, who were the recipients of the tax cut. Middle class taxes generally stayed the same, and because the Social Security tax rose, they would be paying, you know, more money. And, you know, there was some slight reduction of the taxes of the poor. But basically, this tax was quite unique in the fact that it gave nothing to the middle class, okay? And, you know, and in part it was because Carter was oblivious, you know, to the economic needs. I mean, after all, when you talk about fairness and, you know, in tax codes, well, okay, yes, we all want fairness, but the tax code also is one of the means that the American government uses to encourage behavior. In other words, if you want me to build a factory, give me an investment tax. I mean, it doesn't work so, you know, so simply. But essentially, it needs the economy by encouraging things, you know, in that sense. So to completely ignore this, you know, was something which opened up a hole for a new view, you know, which was, you know, the Tax Act of 1978. Nonetheless, the Democrats were still able to manage their majorities. President Carter was still not very popular. But the straw that broke the camel's back was the second oil crisis in Iran, right? Because that did the same thing as the first one did, raising prices, causing a global shortage, you know, spiking inflation. And at this point, the economy was much weaker, you know, than it was in 1973. So this again produces trouble, you know, because inflation spikes because of rising oil prices and also rising food prices. And we often forget about this, but food prices were also important. And so then Carter deals with this energy crisis by decontrolling oil, but that doesn't solve his immediate problem. And he decides that inflation is the most important question. And what he does is he appoints Paul Volcker, although in truth be told, I don't think Jimmy Carter realized what Paul Volcker would do with the interest rates. And in fact, the reason why that's the case was because Paul Volcker was only appointed, you know, because Carter fired half of his cabinets and brought the old head of the Federal Reserve, William Miller, to be his Secretary of the Treasury. So he needed, you know, a new chairman of the Federal Reserve, and that's how Paul Volcker got the position. In other words, it wasn't planned, but Paul Volcker, as people who knew him, you know, was conservative. And the evidence I use in my book from this comes from the nomination files of a man by the name of Richard Moe, who was just a Carter person. Actually, he was a Mondale person, and the files are in Minnesota in the Mondale papers. And he goes through the whole vetting of the candidates. You know, and there were many candidates, and in general, everyone agreed that Volcker was the most conservative of them all and would care more about the international economy than the domestic economy. And indeed, that's exactly how it turned out. He was much more concerned about the international dollar than he was about the domestic, you know, about the domestic economy. But of course, none of this helped poor Jimmy Carter, because what happened in 1980? Okay, he's got this high inflation from the oil prices. Okay, Volcker, using a different method, produces very high interest rates, which add to inflation. And how do we know that? Well, the Fed's minutes demonstrate that the Fed governor said, gosh, one of the reasons why inflation is so high is because our interest rates are so high. But we can't stop it because people won't be convinced that we're serious about inflation. Now, so it was a kind of psychological argument as opposed to, you know, any other. But this is 1980, and because of these interest rates are going up and down, you know, and first of all, they then cause a very severe recession. And this is another first. Just as this tax bill of 78 was the first time, and again, under a Democratic president, you know, of a completely pro-business, and in this case, pro-financial industry tax cut. So this was the first recession that under a Democratic president, where government policy only reinforced the recession. And what I mean by that is Carter's budget was frugal. You know, so in a recession, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to spend money, his was frugal. He cut spending. And what is the Fed supposed to do? It's supposed to cut interest. Well, this went up. We call this pro-cyclical. In other words, what it means is government policy reinforces the bad thing that's happening, and that is the recession. So in 1980, the economy is gyrating. You know, you're getting both inflation and recession. Okay, unemployment is rising, and Jimmy Carter then has to run for re-election. It's a hard time to be running for re-election. Now, the candidate who is opposing him is Ronald Reagan. Now, for those people who think that the election of Ronald Reagan was inevitable, they should read. Remember, after 1976, I quote the Wall Street Journal, which is a Republican newspaper, as many of you know. And they say, after the Republican loss in 1976, the Big Four should absent themselves from Republican politics and let younger men take over. And who were the Big Four? The Big Four were Rockefeller, Ford, John Conley, who was in the Nixon administration, and Ronald Reagan. They thought these four were too old. We need new men. That's the first thing. The second thing, a journalist, Kevin Phillips, who in 1968 had said there's a new Republican majority because of Nixon's election. You know, there was a lot of talk like this, said the Republican Party is dead. Someone else said the Republican Party will meet the fate of the Federalist Party. Remember the Federalist Party, you know, that we've never heard from since. In other words, you know, if you think that the 1970s was a story of, well, the Democrats are getting weaker and weaker and the Republicans are getting, well, the evidence just doesn't show this, in the sense that after 1976, people on the right and the left believed that it was the Republican Party that was in deep trouble. It wasn't so. In 1980, there are two main candidates. I mean, George Bush was the candidate of the business class. I mean, he was the traditional Republican balanced budget, reduced federal spending. I mean, that's the classic Republican. But Ronald Reagan, who opposed Ford in 1976 mainly on foreign policy issues, embraces the domestic economy issue. And what kind of a candidate is he on the domestic front? I mean, what does he embrace? He embraces both traditional Republicanism, but some of the new Republicanism, which emerge in the 70s, but have not achieved majorities anywhere. And what I'm talking about is supply-side economics. Now, again, you know, why does supply-side economics become, it's not that it was so brilliant, it wasn't. But if conventional economics, like Keynesianism, can't fix the economy, you know, there are going to be new ideas, that open. You know, and we've seen, you know, that throughout the 70s, there were many statist ideas, there were ideas for industrial policy, there were ideas for new trade policy. I mean, they never came to be. But my point is that when an economy is in trouble, there is openings. You know, there are openings for new ideas. And in this case, you know, in the late 70s, you know, this notion, what was the idea behind supply-side economics?
Cut taxes that will increase government revenue somehow to make up for the...
That's right. You see, whereas the Keynesians argue, if you cut taxes, you'll increase aggregate demand. What the supply-siders argued is if you cut taxes, you will increase the incentive, so people will work harder. You see, it's a different logic. Sometimes it's confused, you know, and you know, but the logic is, you know, is different. And what they said was you'll get, you know, a lot of revenue. You won't starve the government of revenue at this time. And Reagan was clever enough both to embrace the traditional business views, you know, of taxation, like reduce the corporate tax, cut government spending, but also this newer, you know, supply side, and Reagan was able to articulate, you know, this notion. Finally, he was able to marry his old ideology, you know, that the free market is better, that the state is a brake on production and income. You know, he was finally able to marry this, you know, with an economy which was in trouble. You see, he wasn't quite able to do this in 1976 because the economy was recovering. You know, unemployment was still high, but he couldn't fashion an argument. Remember, at one point he said, "Well, we're going to privatize Social Security," that was, even among conservatives, something that you know, nobody, you know, nobody wanted. And there were other things. And so he couldn't connect his firm belief in market freedom, you know, with the economy. He was able to do it, you know, in 1980. Nonetheless, his victory in 1980, however, you know, polls done about why you voted for X or Y indicated that most of them were not, I mean, you know, most, only a small percentage of people said, I voted for Ronald Reagan because he was conservative. Most people said, I voted for him because, I voted for him, you know, because Jimmy Carter, you know, couldn't do anything. You know, in other words, the notion that people actually knew, you know, what precisely Ronald Reagan was going to do, you know, is a retrospective judgment. In other words, at the time, one of Carter's allies, Reginald Jones, he was the head of General Electric and supported Reagan, and he said, well, I think, you know, we'll just continue with labor management relations as we have done in the past. Well, he was obviously wrong, but nonetheless, even he, you know, because, you know, Ronald Reagan as governor of California was not, you know, terribly reactionary. Yes, he hated the students, you know, but, you know, he hated the Berkeley student. But he signed into law one of the most liberal abortion laws. In other words, the candidate Ronald Reagan was a lot more ideological than the governor Ronald Reagan, you know, who was much more pragmatic. So if you look at businessmen even who are seeing him, you know, they say, you know, he's not, you know, he's not as conservative, you know, as people thought. They still thought they were in the old classical Republican mode. You know, in this sense. So that, you know, I think an argument could be made, you know, that Reagan's success in restoring the economy eventually in 1983, you know, not his argument before he was election, you know, his election was what did, was what, you know, created whatever majorities he did. So Carter lost, even though he tried to resurrect himself with something that could appeal to workers other than inflation. I mean, in other words, if you're promising the American people castor oil, you know, people are not going to vote for you. I mean, you might say that the happy optimist is the happy optimist. Nonetheless, presidents who are elected president usually say, we can do something. I mean, whatever it is, you know, we can be better. We can do things better. I mean, whatever it is. And so, you know, Reagan, you know, with that appeal, you know, understandably, won the election. Okay. Nonetheless, and we're going to talk more about this, you know, because we're going to be reading next week, we're going to be reading a book on PATCO, you know, which was the Air Controllers Union, and we'll see that, you'll see, sorry, I don't want to give away the happy ending of the PATCO book, but Ronald Reagan was not about breaking the union. I mean, he was willing to bargain with the union, and you could argue that the union, you know, got a little extravagant in its demands, you know, which led him to, you know, to say, okay, you're fired. But in any event, we do see a real change. In other words, especially after the economy improves in 80, tax cutting became, you know, the major way of improving the economy. Okay? Unionless factories, you know, became the general mode of organizing, the workplace. And if you combine all of that with free trade, what you can also see is that the sectors which were privileged because of this tax policy tended to be those that were not traded. That is, auto and steel did poorly. What did well? Finance, insurance, housing, defense, of course, you know, and all of this. So this economy that we have today in which trade, what I call tradables, meaning those that can be, you know, those things can be traded, there are fewer of those and more jobs in areas which aren't traded, like housing, like health, you know, healthcare, like personal trainers. Right. I mean, these are jobs, right, where, you know, you can't outsource a personal trainer, you know, in that sense. So if you look at the, you know, so often people say, well, yes, there was an increase in inequality, and there surely was. These tax cuts benefited rich people more than poor people. Now, of course, you know, the justification for this is that it is rich people who create jobs. And the only thing you could say against that is that earlier in American history, most people didn't think that way. In other words, that is one thought, you know, but earlier, there were other thoughts. I mean, you know, but the argument is if you privilege capital by not regulating it too much and not taxing it too much, and letting it go wherever it wants, you know, internationally, you will get prosperity. And as I said, earlier in the class, you know, even with the growing inequality, the system, especially after the 90s, you know, where you get the tech boom, was stable. You know, that doesn't mean people didn't dissent, from the idea, but they could never organize something until the Great Recession, you see. And we'll talk, in the last day of class, what we're going to be talking about is whether, you know, this, shall we say, opening, you know, of 2007-08, you know, did change things in any meaningful ways. Okay, any final thoughts? Everything is all set. It's clear. What about from our C-SPAN men? You're all clear too? You understand?
Next week on Lectures in History, Columbia University history professor Eric Foner discusses the rise of socialism in America in the 20th century. Professor Foner examines the Socialist Party in New York City and Milwaukee, and the Socialist Party of America presidential campaigns of Eugene Debs. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.